Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Brock Specht, and I represent the appellant, Patricia Klawon. I have, at least I intend to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal today.
Counsel, please be reminded that the time shown on the clock is your total time remaining.
Thank you for the reminder, Your Honor.
Okay.
Your Honors, there's little doubt that the district court's decision in this case cannot be upheld. My friends on the other side go through the motions of defending it, but quickly retreat to identifying alternative grounds for affirmance that the district court did not consider. And the reason they're forced to do this is because the district court's order is fundamentally flawed in three ways. First, it confuses the process-based analysis of breach with the outcome-focused question of loss. Second, the district court's order on the issue of loss imposes a substantial loss requirement that is inconsistent with the text of ERISA and is inherently subjective. And just to briefly illustrate that inherent subjectivity, the losses at issue here are in the ballpark of $500 million, which the district court found was undisputed. $500 million is a huge amount of money on its own. It also represents roughly 10% of the total assets of the plan in question. So any way you look at it, that is a substantial loss. And finally, on the prospective relief issue, which relates to standing and class certification, the district court imposed a much higher standard for prospective relief than what this court's cases require, and also made a simple factual error regarding the timing of when Ms. Klawon removed her assets from the plan. So for these reasons, the district court's order granting summary judgment should be reversed. Starting with the issue of breach, the claim under ERISA has four elements: duty, breach, loss, and causation. The district court addresses two of these elements, breach and loss, and gets them both wrong. For the element of breach, this court and every other court I'm aware of has said this is a question of process, not results. Did the fiduciaries follow a prudent process in making the decision they made, regardless of how it turns out? That is the test for breach.
What case are you relying upon to say that the breach is process without looking at the outcome? What case are you relying upon?
There's a number of them, Your Honor, from this court.
Give me your best one.
Certainly, Your Honor. The most recent decision that touches on that is the Anderson versus Intel case. And in that case, this court said we look at the process in evaluating prudence, we look at the process that was used.
You put it in the context of breach. You're not talking about prudence yet, but I thought you said the cases clearly say that for determination of breach, we look at the process only. So I'm asking you what language in Anderson tells us that we only look at the process and not the outcome.
Yeah, and I'm using breach in sort of shorthand method. It's breach of the fiduciary duty of prudence.
I hear you.
Yep.
But I'm still curious about how you come to the conclusion that we have blinders on in terms of determining that it's only on, if the process is flawed, there is a breach regardless of what the outcome is. That's what I think you're arguing. So I'm asking you, what language in Anderson tells us that?
Yeah, this is on page 1021 of the Anderson decision, and I'm eliding some of the language just to be succinct. But what this court wrote was, we evaluate prudence based on the methods the fiduciaries employed rather than the results that they achieved.
Okay, so are you equating prudence with breach? Because you said in determining breach, we look at the process. And so are you saying when that case uses the word prudence, we can plug in the word breach and it means the same thing?
I think that's exactly right, Your Honor. What we're talking about here is a breach of the duty of prudence.
Okay. This
process-based analysis may or may not result in a loss. That's a separate question from, did the fiduciaries follow a prudent process which is the test for the breach element of the claim.
I have a bit of a different concern with the district court's order, and that is it seemed to suggest that in order to prove breach, you have to make a comparison to relative comparators, to underperformance. And perhaps that might have been because the court was saying this without the benefit of Anderson coming out. But Anderson makes clear that you can prove breach based on direct evidence rather than through a circumstantial theory, and you don't have to come up with an underperformance theory that requires comparators. Is there some sort of error in the district court? Am I right in reading the district court of sort of implying that you needed to bring in underperformance as a basis for breach?
You are correct about that, Your Honor, and I think I know where the district court went astray on that. So the district court relies on Anderson and also the Second Circuit's opinion in the St. Vincent case in this portion of the decision that you're
referring. You mean the district court's opinion in Anderson because the circuit one hadn't come out yet.
That's right. And both of those cases were cases involving motions to dismiss at the pleading stage. So there is sort of a wrinkle to this at the pleading stage where a plaintiff doesn't have discovery and doesn't know what the process was. And this court's opinion in Anderson talks about this at length. At that point, a plaintiff can only look to the results and then draw inferences from those results about the process.
Okay, so counsel, let me ask you then, are you saying that in this case, the plaintiffs did not attempt to introduce direct evidence of lack of prudence?
No, Your Honor, the opposite. So
okay. That's
what Anderson is talking about at the pleading stage. We're at summary judgment.
Okay.
So right. We don't need to look at the results and draw inferences about the process. We've taken discovery. We know what the process is. Mm-hmm. So this wrinkle that Anderson acknowledges about evaluating pleadings where the plaintiff lacks that information just isn't relevant here.
Okay. So you say that part's not relevant. So would you point me in the record to the process? The evidence that you think indicated that the motion for summary judgment was wrongfully granted. What's the evidence there?
There's a lot of evidence, Your Honor, and I'll just make the point that the district court, in acknowledging that the rule about breach is process, then skips any discussion of the process. So the evidence is not discussed at all in the district court's opinion. But it is all over the briefs that we filed here. It's all over the briefs that we submitted to the district court. I don't have time.
Well, it's not the briefs. I'm talking about the evidence. Is it? The briefs are what your argument was, but I'm asking you what was the evidence in the record that you relied upon to support your theory that there was no material issue of fact regarding the process.
Right. So the question is, did the fiduciaries here follow an appropriate process for managing
a
the
prudent process?
A prudent process would be an appropriate process. Mm-hmm. And the evidence is primarily about the details of the process that they followed, and it's informed by expert opinion, talking about the standard of care in the industry, what the typical committee does when managing plans like this. And so just to tick off a few examples, the investment implementation that this committee used starting in 2014 when their advisor leaves Merrill Lynch and hangs a shingle on his own is to increasingly allocate more and more assets to very esoteric, unusual alternative investment funds. The committee does not seem to understand that this is a very atypical strategy, that they're moving far out of the mainstream, and they're also not checking against the benchmark, what's called the policy benchmark, that is defined in the plan's investment policy statement. This is the thing they're supposed to be looking at to tell themselves, are we doing the right thing or not? Are the decisions
we're making? So you are relying on comparator evidence, correct?
We are relying, for purposes of evaluating their conduct, the investment policy statement says you're supposed to be looking at this policy benchmark to see, are we steering the ship in the right direction
right.
or not?
So you're looking, so, that's part of your proof, is that you're comparing the outcome to what the benchmark is.
I think that's probably right, Your Honor, but the way I would phrase it is they have an obligation under their investment policy statement to do this, to look at their benchmark and use that as a guidepost.
Right.
So it's not the comparison so much as the failure to make the comparison, that they're
I'm getting confused. I took your allegations to be in part direct evidence of imprudence, that the committee did not adequately look at the overall objectives of the plan membership and did not monitor and was rubber stamping what, you know, what an advisor was doing. And so regardless of whether it was performing well or not relative to others, wouldn't that be direct allegations themselves in, you know, to establish a violation, even without a comparison?
It would be, and Anderson says that that is perfectly appropriate and perfectly acceptable. We have all of that
but
here.
But you are also saying,
and more,
and this fund was performing, underperforming relative to certain comparators that you think are proper comparators and your opposing counsel thinks they're not.
There's a distinction to be made between the measuring the loss. What do you look at as a comparator to measure the loss for this plan versus the process they're following for the prudence analysis? And the reason I bring up the policy index in the context of breach is because this is one of the sort of things that they're supposed to be doing to prudently manage the investments. It's supposed to be part of their process.
Can I ask you this? One of the things that the district court said was that it seemed as if the court was requiring your client to demonstrate that the plan substantially and consistently underperformed. Where does that standard come from?
It's made up, Your Honor. It comes from case law, district, mostly unpublished district court opinions from outside the Ninth Circuit, looking at this pleading standard that Anderson is going to talk about and does talk about in terms of not knowing what the process was and so looking at the results and drawing inferences about the process from those results.
Is there any case that mentions a substantial and consistent underperformance standard?
Not from this court.
I mean, Anderson didn't mention that.
Anderson doesn't mention it. This court has never imposed that standard. I'm certain there's probably some unpublished district court case in Pennsylvania or somewhere that uses that language, but it is not in this court's case law.
And it seemed as if the court was also applying that same standard to the loss analysis as well, saying you can't demonstrate loss unless it's substantial loss. What, you know, and consistent, I guess, over a 10-year period is what the court found was what courts usually decide. Is that grounded in anything in the case law or the statutory text?
So the statute, Section 1109 of ERISA, says any loss. It does not say any substantial loss. This language
So 1 cent would be enough?
1 cent under the statute would be enough, Your Honor. I don't think anyone would
any
sue
any case
her.
Says that? Does any case say that?
I'm not aware of a case that says 1 cent.
So there's no case that says one way or the other, is there, regarding what the amount of loss, what the range is, or
the text doesn't set.
The text says any loss.
Any loss. And there's certainly many cases that award thousands of dollars, couple $10,000. Yeah. The last point I'll make, and I know I'm getting into my rebuttal time, this 1% thing can be, I think, confusing to courts and lawyers. It's not a 1%. It's a 1 percentage point underperformance. So if I have an investment that yields a 4% rate of return and my neighbor has an investment that yields a 3% rate of return, that's a 1 percentage point difference in the rate of return, which is what we're talking about here. But that could be the difference between 4% and 3%, a $4,000 gain versus a $3,000 gain. So that's 25% more money. And if you add that up year after year for a decade, that can be a lot of money. That's why we're talking about $500 million.
Counsel, do you think it would be fruitful for us to remand this case for the district court to reconsider it in light of the Anderson opinion?
I do think it would be fruitful to do that. I don't have much time left. I don't think Anderson's going to be controlling here, but I do think it is informative for the reasons that you articulated, Your Honor, about the distinction between direct evidence and circumstantial allegations and things
like
that.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Josh Hunt for defendants appellees. The district court properly granted summary judgment for defendants, a board with equal union and employer representation that oversees the collectively bargained MPI individual account plan. Undisputed evidence shows that the plan's investments were not the product of an imprudent process, were not objectively imprudent, and were not otherwise a source of imprudence that caused losses. For each of those independent reasons, plaintiff cannot prevail on her claim that defendants.
So, counsel, let me jump in and ask you to address my concerns with the court's order. I see three possible errors here. The first is the court signaling that someone has to establish underperformance as a basis for the breach. And you can tell me if I'm correctly reading the order or not. The second one is this loose standard of substantially and consistently underperformed, which I couldn't find a basis for anywhere in our case law. And our most recent Ninth Circuit decision in Anderson doesn't mention anything of the sort. And then the third one is applying a similar metric for loss, you know, saying that loss is can only be cognizable if it's substantial and consistent, when, as counsel said, the statutory text says any loss. So tell me why the court hasn't erred in using those three standards to apply the summary judgment.
Sure. Thank you, Your Honor. On the breach question, so the way I understand the district court's opinion, and I think this bears out in what is said, is that the court addressed the plaintiff's reliance on underperformance to infer imprudence. The plaintiff absolutely in the district court relied on underperformance to infer imprudence. It also put forward some other direct evidence, but the district court dealt with the effort to infer imprudence from underperformance and said the level of underperformance here is too insubstantial to infer imprudence alone.
But the problem is, I'm sorry to interrupt you, there were allegations of direct evidence.
Right.
Right. And so, but the court doesn't grapple with that. I don't hear anything in I don't see anything in the court's order that talks about the allegations of direct evidence. And so if I'm reading that you have to have underperformance, that seems inconsistent with a theory of direct evidence of a breach.
I don't think the court was, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I don't think the court was saying that underperformance is the only way to prove imprudence. At the end of the district court's order, the district court says, I'm not going to address breach further. So that indicates to me that the district court understood that there were other ways to do breach.
But then why not address the direct evidence allegations?
Because the district court concluded that loss, the absence of evidence of loss caused by imprudence, resolved the case.
Okay.
And so
because there was no loss, no need to reach into breach anymore.
That's the way I understand
it. So then you're hinging everything on loss and the application of a substantial loss as the correct legal standard.
We are not hinging everything. We have alternative arguments for why their so-called direct evidence of prudence is insufficient to allow them to get a remand.
Counsel, could we talk about the status of the plaintiff and how that affects this case? And is her individual case before us? And if it's not, how do we have jurisdiction over this case?
The plaintiff's claims for injunctive relief are moot. Plaintiff cashed out of the plan in August 2023. She has not since rejoined the plan. She hasn't reported even getting a job with an employer in the motion picture industry. Mm-hmm. And in order to rejoin the plan, she would have to work 870 hours in a year for an employer that participates in the plan. None of that's here. Mm-hmm. Her case, her claims for injunctive relief are moot, and they have been since August 2023.
Okay. But she has other live claims, you would agree?
She has a claim for damages.
For damages. Yeah.
For individual damages.
For individual damages, okay.
For individual damages.
Right? I think that she intends to claim damages on behalf of the plan.
Oh,
that's how they get to $500 million. If you know, she did not suffer a $500 million loss.
Doing it on behalf of the plan.
She's doing it on behalf of the plan for damages, at least prior to August 2020.
To Judge Rawlinson's question to opposing counsel, what is your view if we were to remand this to just have a more fulsome analysis with the benefit of Anderson guiding how to approach the direct evidence allegations and other things?
I think that there are many grounds to affirm that don't depend on Anderson.
That would require, I mean, I take your point, but that would require us delving into issues that the district court never addressed herself in the first instance.
I think that you can affirm on the ground that there is no evidence of loss caused by imprudence here. The evidence simply does not establish that the underperformance that's present here is of the sort that was caused by whatever it is that they allege to be imprudent. We're going to start there with their failure to show objective imprudence, which requires showing that no prudent fiduciary would have made the same investment decisions as the planned fiduciaries.
But how could we reach that if plaintiff's allegations are in part that the committee failed to properly monitor, you know, what was going on with the asset advisor, and thereby, you know, suffered this 1% less than that amounts to $500 million. If we were to credit all that for purposes of deciding whether there's a tribal issue, how would we be able to decide that is a basis for affirming?
There are many cases that hold that it is simply no sign of imprudence for a plan to continue to stay invested in slightly underperforming assets. In fact, many courts recognize that precipitously selling underperformers is a sure way to ruin the long-term returns of a plan. And you have cases like Pizarro from the 11th Circuit that make that exact point in the context of objective imprudence.
Is substantial loss a requirement?
So this is the way I would put it, Your Honor. If the underperformance is so slight that a prudent fiduciary would not get out of the investment, then it wasn't objectively imprudent for these planned fiduciaries to stay in the investment. And if it wasn't objectively imprudent, then causation has not been established.
But you're sort of collapsing breach and causation analysis then, right? I mean, if someone has acted imprudently, and then you have to go to whether that imprudence caused the harm and what the loss was. I'm just focusing on the loss side of it. It seems that if you add a substantial loss to that, you have to back it up somewhere. Where in the law would one derive a substantial loss requirement?
Well, I think Pizarro is a good place.
Pizarro?
Yes, that's a 11th Circuit case. That's a good place to start. In the case law, what you'll see is, and unfortunately they don't use the best terms, but there's a distinction that they draw between proving imprudence, and then proving causation. But in order to prove causation, one of the things you have to prove is something they call objective imprudence. But what it really means is that no prudent fiduciary would have made the same investments.
But we're talking about loss. It's
yes.
Separate and apart from the prudence prong.
Yes.
So the measure of loss, what case are you relying upon to say that it has to be something more than insignificant in your view? What case tells us that any loss means more than de minimis?
Again, I don't want to fight the language of 1109. 1109 says any loss.
That's the language we're left with.
And so I'm not trying to contradict that. But what I'm saying is that when the loss is slight, let me directly answer your question. Pizarro is the best place to start for the notion that slightly underperforming is not proof of loss.
Could you point me to the precise language in Pizarro that you're relying upon, the page and the language?
I'm afraid I don't have that directly at hand, Your Honor. It is towards the end of the opinion, I can tell you that.
That's all right. I don't want you to waste your time looking for it. I thought because you cited that case, you would know exactly the language that's there.
I don't have a quote in front of me, Your Honor. The distinction I'm drawing is that if it was entirely possible to link $1 of loss and show that it absolutely was caused by imprudence, then maybe that $1 would be recoverable. But when you have slight underperformance, and again, underperformance is not the same thing as loss. When you have only slight underperformance, it undermines it or refutes the objective imprudence.
But I think if I'm understanding your argument, you seem to be arguing it as if plaintiff's theory was only circumstantial evidence of underperformance. But that's not the case here. And I know you dispute that there's tribal evidence for direct evidence, but at least the allegations are there, right? And the allegations are improper monitoring, rubber stamping, you know, imprudent advice decisions by the asset advisor. And so if that's the case, then we get to loss, perhaps in a different context than what you're describing. And there might be an ill fit with substantial loss in the context of a direct breach type of case.
I'm not aware of any case law that draws that distinction. I think that what I was talking about, and sorry if I was unclear, is really loss and causation. But let me turn.
Counsel, before you move on that point, I'm looking at Pizarro, page 1176, and I think this is what you're relying upon because it says to recover damages, plaintiffs must show that the investments made were not objectively prudent. That means they must have fallen outside the range of reasonable judgments a fiduciary may make based on her experience and expertise. It says, so liability turns not only on an imprudent process, but also in that process resulting in an imprudent investment. In other words, losses are only compensable if they are caused by a fiduciary's bad decisions rather than by the vagaries of the market. So it's kind of putting the imprudence and the damages together in a way.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yeah, like I said, the objective imprudence is categorized as a causation doctrine, but it does have a flavor of asking what a hypothetical prudent fiduciary would do. So that was the distinction I was trying to draw. I'm sorry if I wasn't clear about that. But I do want to, in my dwindling time, address the allegations of imprudence, because I think it's telling that we're using the word allegations. We're not at the motion to dismiss stage. We're at summary judgment. And plaintiff has not come forward with any specifics. And I think that came through when my friend was asked about what's your evidence of imprudence, and it was all generalities. And even the generalities that he mentioned are absolutely refuted by the record. Just to take the example of not comparing the plan performance to a policy index. There is report after report after report in this record, every quarter, where the plan performance is compared expressly to the policy index. So it is absolutely not the case that they never compared this plan performance to the policy index. It is there. The same is true about the committee not understanding the investment. There is discussion after discussion after discussion in the committee minutes from 2014, 2015, 2016, 2017, all throughout that period where they're discussing the strategy and why they're going to put uncorrelated alternatives into and increase the amount of uncorrelated alternatives in the plan portfolio. Because the nature of this plan is that it's all pooled assets, and when a retiree leaves, they have to cash out entirely, which creates a big risk that on the eve of someone's retirement, they are going to suffer a huge loss if the market goes down. And the plan reasonably decided that they wanted to mitigate that by putting in uncorrelated assets that won't move with the market. And that's exactly how the plan ended up performing. It underperformed during bull markets. It outperformed during bear markets. That's what they expected, and that's how it performed.
Before your time runs out completely, you have 10 seconds, but on your conditional cross appeal, if we were to agree with you that the plaintiff no longer has standing for her individual injunction claim, wouldn't the proper remedy would be to remand to give plaintiffs a chance to substitute in a new class representative rather than your argument, which is to decertify, that the court abuses discretion certifying the class?
The answer is no, and there's two reasons, if I can keep
yes,
going,
please.
Your Honor. The first, it's a conditional cross appeal. So if you affirm summary judgment, then the conditional cross appeal goes away. Second, the law is clear, and you see this in cases like Hualua and Slayman, that if the mootness arises before the class is certified, then the class must be decertified. And here it did arise before class was certified.
But if we didn't agree with you about that, if we thought the court didn't abuse its discretion in certifying the class at the time, but since then recognize that there is not standing for the plaintiff, would you agree then that the proper course is to remand and allow plaintiffs to substitute in a new representative?
The case law does say that if mootness arises after class certification, then an opportunity to substitute is appropriate.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just as a reminder, this is a summary judgment decision.
We understand, counsel. You don't have to remind us.
Thank you, Your Honor. My friends conceded that we did present direct evidence related to the breach. The district court did not consider that evidence at all. Instead, the district court said, without a, quote, substantial loss, there can be no breach. That is unsupported by any decision of this court. Pizarro does not say that. That portion of the district court's opinion is absolutely erroneous. Very briefly on the prospective relief issue, the standing class cert, all those issues kind of collapse together. In the employment context, for prospective relief, this court has spoken directly to the standard that should be applied. That's the Bolden-Hartage case from 2023. A plaintiff may have standing when she is in the process of seeking work from or reinstatement with the employer, but she lacks standing when there is no indication of a continued wish to work for that employer. That's the standard. If you're seeking reinstatement, you have standing.
But isn't it speculative at this point, counsel? I mean, more than 4 years have passed, and it wouldn't just be reinstatement. It would have to be the 180 hours in a calendar year.
I see my time, Your Honor. May I briefly
Please
answer?
Respond.
So more than 4 years, it's not speculative. More than 4 years had not passed. 1 year had passed. This is where the district court gets the timing wrong. When the case was filed in 2020, Ms. Klawan was a participant in the plan. She had not removed her money. She did not do so until June of 2023. So it had only been a year at the time of summary judgment. During that year, Ms. Klawan maintained her active status in the union, paid her union dues for active status. She continued to take continuing education courses in order to maintain her skills. She was listed as one of the craftspeople that were available for additional work in the industry. And probably most importantly, this plan is designed for people to be able to take their money out and then go back to work and rejoin the plan. So this is not speculative. This is not a bug. It's a feature of the plan.
Yes, counsel, but we can take judicial notice of the amount of time that's passed.
Well, you can take judicial notice, Your Honor, but it was 1 year at the time of the summary judgment.
Okay.
And the record, we don't know what's happened since
then. We understand your argument, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you to both counsel for your helpful arguments. The case just argued is submitted for decision by the court.